Hi, thanks so much for joining us today. My name is Michelle Young, and I am here presenting Heartfelt Consciousness, my Vinyasa Practice podcast. And I am so thrilled to bring you our guest today. We have Lori Holden and Sherry Fisher, and they have recently published a book called Standing Room Only, How to Be That Yoga Teacher. You can get it on Amazon. There'll be a link in the podcast description. Now, I want to take a moment just to talk a little bit about y'all's background before we get started. Sherry has been teaching yoga for over 20 years, right, Sherry?
Yeah. I've been practicing for 20 years, teaching since 2010.
Beautiful, beautiful. So yeah, definitely getting there. And Lori is your sister. And she is a practitioner and has really helped to give a practitioner's perspective in this particular book. So the book really helps to identify the pillars of excellent teaching, not only from through the lens of the teacher, but also through the lens of the student, which is what makes this book so unique. I'm really excited to have y'all today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Your book, Standing Room Only, How to Be That Yoga Teacher. You'll talk a lot about the five pillars of teaching, and this being one of the first pillars and maybe one of the most important. So I'd love to just dive right in and get y'all's feedback and thoughts on what aspects are important about communication and communicating with your students.
I think communication is one of the most basic things we as humans have. It's how we interact with each other. And it really comes to the forefront of a good yoga teacher because it puts that those communication skills to the test. Because as a yoga teacher, you are leading a class and you are using many different aspects of communication in order to communicate to your students what it is you want them to do. Because when students come into their yoga practice, they want you to guide them through it. Now, we also, as yoga teachers, we make suggestions and the students make the decisions as to what they want to do. But you bring somebody in who's maybe not very familiar with yoga or they have a couple of special considerations. And as a yoga teacher, you really become the lead on all of that. So communication, I think, is super important for all yoga teachers. And a lot of times people think, well, that includes cueing, like what I'm telling them to do. It absolutely does. But when you think about all of the different ways that our messages are communicated to each other, there's an entire communication like feedback loop. So I put together words based on my experience, my education, what it is I'm trying to convey to you. And I say that to you, but there's a lot of other things that come into play. So it's not just what I say, it's how I say it. It may be what else is going on. And really only about 7% of the message is communicated by what you say. And so there's a lot of other different ways that I think we need to think about communication and the multifaceted ways that we send and receive messages from each other. And then also that feedback loop is important because I may say something to you and I think that's crystal clear. And yet through the filter that you hear and see and sense things, it may not come across as clear. And when you're teaching yoga, that can really come out because you think, I just gave them a very clear direction on what I want them to do. And you see half the class doing it and half the class not doing it. And that's when you know, I must have had a little bit of a breakdown in communication. It happens, but it's how we learn. It's how we learn how to be better communicators. And so I think it's, as a yoga teacher, some of the things we want to pay attention to are who's in our class, like what abilities, what experience, what agility do they have as they come into the classes? And then also, it's also looking at like, what are their expectations? So I always like to think about if my class is described on, let's say, the website, what does it say? Because if a student is looking at that and they come in, that's what they're going to expect to get from the class. And that's what I want to deliver. Or tell them that it's going to be something different. Again, that's just different layers of communication. It can also be verbal preferences. A lot of times in yoga, we use Sanskrit words. And a lot of times what I recommend is matching them up. So if you say Utkatasana, somebody may or may not know what that is because literally it's another language. And so if you say Utkatasana chair pose, And then there's also nuances from studio to studio. It could be called cheer pose here. It could be called fierce pose. It could be called, we don't know. And so as a teacher, I like to really tune into what is it that the students know and don't know, and how can I bridge that gap so that what I am saying and telling and communicating to them, it's landing for them, they're getting it, and that helps them to have a better yoga experience.
Absolutely, Sherry. I couldn't agree with you more. Lori, I'd love to hear a little bit about how you view communication, and maybe, you know, even a little bit of elaboration on the way that you communicate non-verbally with your students and what you have found successful.
Yeah, so let me back up just a little bit and tell you a little bit about the partnership that Sherry and I have. We are sisters, and so we go way back, like way back. And Sherry is a yoga teacher. I am a yoga taker. I'm a yoga practitioner. And so together we have come up with the Root to Rise yoga teaching method. So it has kind of both the teacher and the student viewpoints in it. So I'm really glad you asked about communication from my point of view, because that's part of the feedback. That's the circle, the cycle between two people. And when we're talking about communication, that is the connections between the two people, that what makes those connections. Connection is another one of the pillars that we'll get to, but they're all very intertwined. So I was smiling earlier because I was remembering some times in class where the teacher has said right and meant left, and didn't really understand that half the class was confused. Some listened to what she said, some listened to what she meant. And so when she looked up and got out of the pose herself, she laughed, and it was all okay. But it just shows that there are some times where you think you're communicating clearly and the message is not received in the way that you think. So I think it's really being present so that you are there to read the room. You are there to connect with, almost on two levels, connect with the individuals in your class and the class as a whole. And continually read that feedback from individuals in the class and from the class as a whole. If there's a lot going on, it sounds very basic, but there's a lot within that that's going on for, you know, almost everything we do is for both new teachers and skilled teachers, because there's always layers, just like any yoga pose. You can always, you know, one of my beautiful teachers calls it the infinity of the pose. So anyway, I feel like that's what it is with the infinity of communication. We can always get a little bit deeper, hone our craft a little bit on that.
Thank you so much, Lori. Definitely it speaks to me and that constant inner work that a teacher has to do, and you know how important it is to be fully present with your students in class to really be able to pick up those nuances, because that's a lot of the communication is under the surface a little bit. So definitely important. I'd love to hear a little bit more about, you know, how we as teachers can communicate effectively and yet not over communicate. I think that's one thing that women struggle with in general, is over communicating and over explaining ourselves. And sometimes I'll go into a yoga class and I will, the feedback that I have for the teachers, they're just talking too much. There's not enough space in between. So, you know, what are y'all's thoughts on that?
I think it's always a delicate balance between talking too much and talking too little. And in the book, we call it the Goldilocks approach. Not too much, not too little, just right. And it's going to depend on who your students are, how skilled they are, what knowledge, the previous knowledge they have coming in, of course. But it's also from the yoga teacher's perspective. I found when I first came out of my yoga teacher training that I was depending on certain cues. Like we had learned probably a handful of cues to get students into each of the poses. And I really leaned on that, like bring your feet together, bend your knees, you know, the standard cues that we use. And then as I started to learn more and more, and I listened to the ways other yoga teachers referred to their cueing, I thought, oh, I want to use that too. And I want to use that too. And suddenly now I had way too much in my repertoire and I wanted to share everything I knew about every pose. And so it was almost like I went from too little to, just like you said, Michelle, too much. We want to over explain. And part of the beauty of the yoga practice is allowing the students to do their own inner work in between the breaths, in between the cues, in between the poses, in the transitions, all of that. And so giving enough space between your cueing for me can sometimes be hard because I do want to share everything that I know. And yet when I'm practicing, and Lori really contributed to this, there's this beauty in the pause and there's this beauty in the silence when you are listening to your breath as a student, when you are able to be in the space and maybe notice some of the thoughts that are happening in this pose, but they're probably also happening off of your mat. I always refer to the mat as sort of my little mini laboratory. Like what happens here probably happens everywhere else. And so being with myself, that's really a lot of the beauty of the yoga practice. And I'll give you an example. So I had a fellow student at the yoga studio where I'm going right now. She just purchased the book and she said, "Oh, I read the part on Goldilocks and I just need to give you this information." She said, "I've been teaching at," she teaches at a ski resort for the employees. And she said, "I was kind of beating myself up because I felt like I was talking way too much." And she said, "But then I read that section of your book." And she said, "But what I realized is none of them have done yoga before. And so what I thought was over-cueing would be over-cueing in a studio like this." And we were standing in the studio. She said, "But for these particular students, they don't know what these poses look like. They don't know what they feel like. And so if I am over-cueing, it's because it matches who my students are." And I thought that was such a beautiful approach. And so for yoga teachers, I'll tell you this. One of the tools that I use is record yourself teaching and then play it back to yourself and actually practice with your own, with your voice cueing you and notice, is it too much? Is it too little? And then even change your filters. Like, okay, if I were a beginning student, remembering back when I first started practicing, would this be too much? Would it be too little? Would I know what that word was? And so it's a great way to assess your own cueing. What words are you using? What phrases? Are you talking too much? All of that. If you do that, if you kind of do it for yourself and give yourself a little assessment.
100%. In fact, every teacher that comes through training, that is my biggest recommendation is, you know, film yourself or record yourself teaching. We used to do it, you know, we would actually like record ourselves teaching public classes and then go home and like take that class. Sometimes we would film it. That was back in the old days of YouTube, but you know, like it was really, really educational. You get so much out of that. I'd love to hear Lori's perspective just from a student perspective, because I know every student has a different lens, right? And if I was working with my teacher, I would listen to her talk all day long. It doesn't matter. But if I go into another class, you know, maybe I don't know the teacher and I just want to drop out of thinking, then I'm like, less is more, you know, I don't have any attachment there. I just want to, you know, be in my body, be in my practice. So Lori, what are your thoughts on that Goldilocks zone and achieving that perfect balance when you're teaching as a student?
It's such an important thing to think about. And as Sherry's thinking about or talking about the Goldilocks spot, I'm thinking about this symbol, which is my symbol. I have that as a pop socket on my phone. It's so resonates for me because we're always trying to find that middle way for me as a yoga practitioner, where I'm not too much and not too little on the pose, on my breath, and how I live my life, what like Sherry was saying, off the mat as well as on the mat. So this ties in with why we decided to call our method the Root to Rise Yoga Teaching Method. Because what I find is that the teachers who speak the appropriate amount and the appropriate guidance are the ones who are rooted. They have done that deep inner work. Not just have done it, they continually do it. It's a practice for them. And so this appropriateness, this confidence, this connection, this communication comes from those roots that are continually being fed and nourished and paid attention to. And so that's the rising piece. And to more directly answer your question, Michelle, I cannot think of a time, I think I'm very lucky. I cannot think of a time when I've had an over chatty yoga teacher who was maybe talking out of nervousness or compensating for something. Or one who has talked not enough and not given the right cues. I think I've been really lucky finding those people who, by the time they got to me, were rooted and blossoming out of those roots.
I love it. Well, thank you so much for sharing a student's perspective. Always very important. So I want to talk a little bit about oppositional cueing. What is it and why is it important? This is in chapter 3 on using your voice.
Yeah, so oppositional cueing, when we were in our teacher training, we were learning one-dimensional cueing. Tell them to do this. It's when you want your students to do something. Lift your arms up. Inhale, fold forward, exhale. So it's giving them directions, basically, instructions on what you want them to do. And that is absolutely a great way to help students get into poses, to direct them. Oppositional cueing, to me, adds in more dimensions. And so, for example, you're giving them two different cues in two different directions, two or more different directions in their body. So let's say, for example, we just came into Warrior Two. One directional cueing would be step your right foot forward, open up Warrior Two. So you're telling them, put your foot here and do this. And then as they're in the pose, the oppositional cueing helps them to refine the pose. And I think the one-dimensional cueing is to take the pose, and the two-dimensional or oppositional cueing helps them to shape the pose. And so in our Warrior Two example, I may invite you to root down through your feet. And then I can also say, and imagine there's a string at the top of your head that's gently lifting the top of your head up towards the ceiling, lengthening your spine. So now I have their attention both rooting down and lifting up at the same time. And then you can add another dimension. You could say, extend your right fingers forward, left fingertips back. And so what you're trying to do is help them grow into the pose and refine it. And again, there's that balance with talking too much. And so it could be that you invite them to do one or two cues on one side and then add in one or two on the other with that oppositional cueing so that it helps them fill the shape instead of just take the shape. So that's, I think that's when I first started, it was just the one-dimensional cueing. I'm like, I want them to move into this pose and use this movement in order to do it. But as you start to help them refine the pose, I think that's what takes it from a basic yoga class, getting into basic poses, into really embodying each pose and embodying each transition, embodying each moment of silence as they're in the poses. And that's where that oppositional cueing really comes in.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So
much. It's more the Tao. You're right. You know, when my teacher David is cueing me in plank, he's having me bring the left and right half of my body together in an integration. And then at the same time, he's opposing and having me like split them out in two is what he says. So I'm doing both of those opposing things at the same time. And that just, that helps me so much on the mat and off the mat.
Mm-hmm, and I definitely think it also, it invites our students to be more mindful. And if I were to say to anybody listening right now, what's going on with the left pinky toe on your foot? Suddenly you go, Oh yeah, I do have a pinky toe down there. That's right. Because we tune out. And so that cueing, and especially the oppositional cueing, I think helps people to come back, to tune back in and not just put their body in the plank position, but now what does it really feel like? Be here right now.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, I mean, and this sort of takes us, you know, into another realm really, because I'll oftentimes say there's instruction and there's teaching. So, you know, teaching, there are even elements of coaching, you know, embedded within teaching. So talk to me a little bit about how cueing and coaching differ and how oppositional cueing can help you to coach your students.
And let me tell you as well on your teaching and instruction, the difference between the two. We actually started with the Root to Rise teaching method with the Pillars of Powerful Instruction is what we called it. But I agree with you. I think there is a difference between being an instructor and being a teacher. And it has to do with that rooting, and it has to do with your intentions and how you bring that out. I taught fitness classes way before I taught yoga, and it was a lot of instruction, and I wanted them to do certain things, and that was my goal. But it's when you're able to add in that extra, and also it's the rooting down, it's the practicing, and also how that comes out through your teaching practice. That's when we move into teaching and not simply instructing. Both take a lot of skill, but it's that elevation up to teaching and seeing yourself and treating yourself as a teacher that I think is really important. And like you said, healing statements, I think, are definitely from an instructor's point of view. Here's what I want you to do. Here's how I want you to do it. When you move into cueing statements, it moves beyond just the physical postures, and it helps to see the students and really recognize them for their efforts. So it goes beyond just directing them to really enhance how you see them in the practice, how they see themselves in the practice. And so cueing can be more about...
These would be coaching statements, right, Sherry?
Yeah, the coaching statements really enhance that. And then the cueing is about the pose. It's about the sequencing. It's about the framework of the class. And the coaching is really where you are asking them to refine it. So those oppositional cues help them fill the pose. But then the coaching statement comes in and acknowledges their efforts, sees them as students, encourages them to push through when it's hard or step back when they're challenged too much, and listen in, be mindful. All of those are more the coaching statements. And I think that softens it. And so a lot of times I'll use coaching statements either after I've already cued them into the pose and maybe they hold it for several breaths and I encourage them with a coaching statement, or I will instruct it more on the first side so they understand how to get into the shape. And then I'll coach them on the second side. So I don't have to give them as many refining cues unless I see something. And we can talk about that too, unless I see something that absolutely needs some cueing. But then I can use the second side of the sequence to really enhance them and talk more about the practice than about the poses.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Beautiful. No, I think one of the ways that I've been using, I think the technique that you're talking about more recently is helping students to find alignment in their posture, right? Doesn't look this certain way. What is alignment? And so sometimes I'll even set it up. I'll say, you know, in yoga, alignment is, you know, load optimization. Like we are balancing your structural load across your frame, your structural frame. And so when you're in Warrior Two, can you identify which foot has more weight in it? And can you use that awareness to pull the weight evenly between the front and the back leg? So it's like, it's an inquiry, you know, into this, you know, and trusting themselves and learning how to trust themselves and develop a relationship with the asana that then they can take off the mat. Sort of what Lori said earlier, it's like, oh, you know, finding that, you know, that yin and that yang, the balance, you know, between the two, is not something that somebody can tell you. It's something you have to experience in your practice, but then also in your life. So I think that's, you know, beautiful. One of the things that we struggle with a little bit in our yoga community is demonstrations and demoing. There are some studios that will not allow it, like literally will not allow it. And what we've found in our studio, because our population, you know, is diverse, and we have a lot of people who have either been practicing yoga at home, or maybe, you know, they've come into a studio, maybe they love being in studio, they've been in for years, but it's a very diversified population. And so our students really lean heavily on demonstrations and demoing. And I have, you know, mixed opinions on this, obviously, as a teacher and a trainer. I'd love to hear your thoughts about when to demo and why and what's appropriate demonstration in a class.
And I think absolutely, if your studio says, please don't demonstrate, as a teacher, if you want to teach there, you're going to adapt to that. And you're mm-hmm. going to adapt your sequencing and your cueing in order to be able to do that. In the first studio where I taught, sometimes the classes were so packed, there was not a place for me to even set up a mat. Many times I would be up on in the back corner on a stool looking at my students. And so there was no demonstrations. And it did change the way that I taught. I didn't teach a lot of intricate sequencing or poses that they weren't super familiar with. And if I did anything really outside the norm, I would demonstrate it prior to class. I would say, there's a transition. It's a little funky transition. I want to show it to you. So I'd have them just sitting down and I would show them at the same time. I would say, and then I'll invite you to do this. And then I'll do this so they could see it before I actually was cueing it for them. So that was one way that I did that. If you are going to do demonstrations, there are a couple of things that I think are really important. And that is to, and I do think demonstrations can be important because we learn a lot visually. Some of us are visual learners and we learn more better if we're seeing something happening than just hearing it or reading about it or studying it. So it's also knowing your population. Like you were saying, Michelle, there's different people who come in, and maybe for them, demonstrations are really important. But as a teacher, I think it's understanding who your students are, understanding your space, understanding the studio's protocols and what they would like, and also what you're comfortable with. And so for me, I do what is called inline demonstrations, and that's if I have a mirror, so that I can still see my students, and I'm doing it in the same direction that they're doing it. So if I invite them to step their right foot forward, my right foot is going forward at the same time. And I can see the room through the mirrors just to see, am I communicating with them? That feedback loop. Mirroring them is different. That's when I'm facing the students and I am doing the opposite. So if I say, step your right foot forward, I am moving my left foot forward. It's as though they are looking in the mirror. It's a little bit more of an advanced technique because we have learned from kindergarten what our rights and lefts are. And then now you're cueing one way with your voice and doing something different with your body. And so it does take a lot of practice. But I think there are some transitions that work better if you are facing in the same direction, or if you're not circulating them around their mat, because they can get really confused. And I think you'll know when that happens because people stop, they are on the wrong foot, and this is how you learn. But I will say it does take practice. So if you are going to start doing some of those demonstrations, especially the mirroring them, facing them, I would definitely practice. And one other thing I think that I would mention here is make sure your placement in the room. So if you have them all turned around one way and you're on the complete opposite side of the room, they can't see a demonstration anyway. And so it's thinking ahead. If I have them facing to the right, I need to be on that side of the room in order to show them this demonstration. And so I think that demonstrations are really important for students, especially if they are visual learners, if it's an intricate transition. But as teachers, it's something that we also have to be good at, because we can confuse them just as much as we can clarify things with our demonstrations, depending on how well we do them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Lori, what's your perspective as a student? How do you feel about demonstrations?
I am a visual learner and I love seeing how the pose can look, so that I have like a place to go in my mind. But I did want to circle back, Michelle, to what you were saying about the cueing that you use on percentage in your feet and things. Until I started practicing yoga, I was a person who lived in my head. And those types of cues you just gave, observe what percentage of your weight is in your front foot, what percentage of your weight is in your back foot, that so helped me move it all the way down from where I usually lived into the other parts of my body. So I just think there's so much value in that that has nothing to do with yoga. Like Sherry was saying about the pinky finger, just getting me into my body. So I really appreciate that.
Absolutely. I think getting people into their body is so important. And that actually, you know, demoing sometimes can prevent people from getting in their body. And this is just my experience as a teacher. But what I'll notice is the days that the classes are too packed and, you know, I can't demo for them. If I say, so let's say we were in Warrior One and I've got their hands, you know, framing the front foot. And I say, step your left foot to meet your right, and the right foot's at the top of the mat, half of them will go back into chaturanga and just move straight into, and the other half are going into forward fold. And it's always interesting because I think about it, I'm like, you know, I don't know what is going on in somebody else's head. Who am I to say? But I know if that happens to me, that is an indication to me in my practice that I am not present. I am someplace else. You know, I've sort of dropped out of being embodied and into, you know, what am I doing next? What's the next thing in my day? You know, this is the sequence I know, right? So I think that, you know, it can go, you know, both ways. Demoing can be really important. And it can also sort of illustrate when we have become a little bit disembodied. And going back to the demoing for just one second, you know, it is so important when we're working with students, just like Sherry said, to make sure that we're visible if we're demoing something. I cannot tell you how many times I see, you know, teachers demoing in the back of the room, people can't see. If you have anyone with any sort of hearing impairment, like demoing in front of them is so important because it gives them that reference. And, you know, even going a step further and demoing so that they can see your lips, you know, just really, you know, going that extra step to create, you know, an opportunity for connection through communication, I think is so important. So all great, great points to make for sure.
I'd like to add in as well, something you just brought up, which is my transition between when I'm teaching and when I'm practicing, because when I'm teaching, I am seeing students practice. And it helps me also to understand when I slide out into, you know, maybe into my brain or out of the room sometimes, because I'm thinking about something else. It also helps me understand the entire practice of yoga from different lenses, different perspectives, because it's different when I'm on my mat feeling it and sometimes spacing out or doing the wrong move or something like that. And then when I'm teaching, I see some of these things. And so for me, it creates a better, more complete picture of my own yoga practice through my teaching practice and through my yogi practice.
Beautiful. No, I can't agree more. Definitely. What ways can we use communication to help students customize their practice? And this is something I'm always working with myself, because ideally they will develop a home practice. You know, studios are great, teachers are lovely, but what I know I'm trying to cultivate within students that come through our school or our, you know, studio for just asana classes is the confidence, the connection to inner knowing, where they can begin to listen to their body and identify what their body needs. And I think that that is a huge part of teaching versus instruction. You know, instruction's taking you through a routine, right? But ultimately not giving you that other piece of like, how do I transfer this into like a lifelong personal practice? So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, customizing your practice, you know, the first thing I think about is using props. And all bodies are different. Like you were saying with the poses earlier, everybody experiences the different poses differently because our bones are different lengths, the way our ligaments come together, the way our muscles are, our weight, all of that. It's all different. I think when I started practicing yoga, probably 20 some years ago, I thought that props were a weakness. Like if you're a really good student, you won't need props. Not that I can't imagine or remember a teacher actually saying that, but that was what my thought was. What I've come to realize is props are really, they are such wonderful tools for me to deepen my practice. And so being able to help and show people how to use the props and encourage them to do so, I think it really does help them to customize their practice to go with any or all of those differences that we have as human bodies, but also where we are on our path. And Michelle, in my 300 hour that I did with my vinyasa practice, I really relished the information that we got about that through like the adaptive yoga sequence section of my curriculum and really all the way throughout, because I do think it's important for us as teachers to recognize and see each person as their own separate entity, and at the same time balancing that with seeing the entire room. We teach to the room, we teach to the student, and we really balance that throughout. And I do think that especially after COVID and people are tuning online a lot more, which I think is great. But we as teachers in studio are balancing that out and inviting them to customize it. And I will say I started doing a Iyengar practice, and then I went over to a Bikram. And in Bikram, there was like, this is the right way to do this pose, and this is how you do it. And I think we have branched away so much from that, in that this is the basis of it. And now where are you in this posture? And it might be that I'm sitting down, you're doing handstands and I'm sitting down, and that's customizing it for me. And I think as teachers, it's important to open up that latitude and welcome students. And I will say sometimes I'm here to guide you through your practice. I make suggestions, you make decisions that are best for you. And I think that's like my underlying philosophy is every student is different, and we need to acknowledge that as teachers.
Absolutely. No, I that's the individuality of our students is important. And it's, you know, that is, again, another aspect of a teacher is someone who can, you know, really perceive and get that feedback from their students so that they can customize for that particular individual. Which leads us into our next question. And, you know, communication is a two-way street, and we are always gathering information from, you know, others as we are, you know, communicating with them. So how do you gather information from your students? And, you know, there's a couple different things that come to mind here, Sharon. I'd love to get both your feedback and Lori's feedback. One thing that comes to mind is, you know, how do you, you know, check in with them and see, you know, how the class was for them without it being an I, me, my sort of thing, you know, without it being all about the teacher. How do you, you know, check in to see if a pose was comfortable when you perceive that perhaps it was not comfortable and they were not going to move out of that posture, you know? So again, you know, just trying to create autonomy within our students, but also gain information.
I think, let me answer that last point first, is I love to check in with my students. And I think a lot of that comes from that connection that you have with them, that trust, and getting to know your students. And so sometimes it's a surface, you know, what do you have going the rest of the day? But other times it can be, I noticed, I gave you that adjustment when you were in some pose. And tell me about it. Did that feel right? Was the pressure right? Like, letting them know that I am working with them to enhance how I teach and how I teach them. And I want their feedback. I need their feedback, and I encourage their feedback so that we have that two-way street, that reciprocity between each other, that open line of communication. And I think that comes from the connection piece. And I do like getting feedback from my students, and I will go up and ask them, how did that feel for you? Or was this confusing when I said this? Do you have a better way that I could describe it from a student standpoint? And so I think inviting that two-way communication. And you'll know which students will give it to you and which ones maybe wouldn't be open to it. I usually do. But I don't know, Lori, is there anything else you would like to add to it from a student's perspective?
Well, Sherry, in just in your last two responses, you've given a word that I think is so important in communication, and that's inviting. You invite your students to customize, and you invite your students to give feedback. And so that it's a very open posture. And so I think that's a nice piece of communication, is to have that. And it is what kind of makes the circular flow of it when you're like this. So yeah, I think it's that invitation.
Yeah. And then Michelle, I wanted to go back with that two-way street. And I do think that from a teaching perspective, when I came out of my yoga teacher training, I had a lot of technique. I had a lot of, here's what the poses are, here's how you cue the poses, here's how you put together a sequence. We practiced it. I had a great 200-hour and a great 300-hour yoga teacher training. I think once we step onto the floor, we start playing with those pieces, and we are putting together classes. And a lot of times they're great classes. I think as we develop as teachers, I started to think more broadly of not just being the instructor, putting them into poses, but being able to be present with them. And that there was just sort of a threshold that I went over, that it's when you are able to see what's happening in the room, and not just with your eyes, definitely with your eyes. You want to see if somebody's struggling in a pose, if they're in an alignment that's not safe that maybe you can help with. But it's also sensing. It's sensing what's happening for each student, but also within the room. And there's cues that we use our five senses for, like, what are you seeing? What are you hearing? Like, maybe you're hearing somebody really panting in the back of the room. Okay, what's going on back there? You look around, everybody's really sweating, or they're not sweating. And let's say you thought at this point in the class they would be sweating. Maybe somebody's super distracted. Maybe they're looking at their phone, or maybe they're looking out the window. And how can you invite them to come back into their practice? And so it's that presence. But I also think it's that intuitive sense. And Michelle, you talk about this quite a bit as well. It's connecting in with the energy of the room and connecting with each and all of your students. And that's how we can orchestrate and create that connection so that it is two-way communication. It's not just we're teachers and we're telling our students things or showing them things. it's a full circle. They are telling and showing us as well. And that's what I think informs us as teachers as to how to best teach.
I love it. I love it. Beautiful. Well, I'm really thrilled that we had the opportunity today to sit down and talk about the first pillar, communication, in your brand new book, Standing Room Only, How to Be That Yoga Teacher. You can buy the book on Amazon in hard copy. There's also a digital copy as well. And we're going to be visiting with Lori and Sherry for a couple more weeks. We've got four more pillars to discuss. And we invite you to grab the book and listen along with us. If you are part of the MVP book club, we will be featuring the book this coming month in June. And we're really excited about that, excited about getting these conversations going. Ultimately, the biggest thing for everybody to remember is that we are always in the seat of the student. Books like this and conversations like these really do help us to grow and expand our perspective. And I cannot tell you how invaluable that is if you really want to be an excellent teacher. So thank you so much for joining me, ladies. And again, we will see y'all next time.
Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you.